This week's episode of Write Minded is brought to you by She Writes University. Unlock your writing career with expert instruction and author-led courses on every subject from marketing your book on social media to querying agents. Put your writing first with She Writes University.
Hello, fantasists, phantasmagorious prophets, diviners, soothsayers, wizards, and alchemists. We're talking with Victoria Schwab today, the brilliant fantasy writer. So we're going to discuss escaping the confines of this world to venture to other worlds that might just help us learn about the world we live in as well. And I'm here with my otherworldly co-host, Brooke Warner. And Brooke, I've heard novels sometimes dismissed as being escapist, so if that's a bad thing, and fantasy novels in particular. And my response is, what's the matter with being escapist? I think we need to escape sometimes, simply to nourish ourselves elsewhere and to get a little respite. And I think escaping is one of the 1,256 benefits of stories that I've tallied, because sometimes going to another world in your imagination will tell you a lot about the world you're living in. What's your angle on stories that provide escape?
It's funny, isn't it, that we criticize a pastime that's basically designed to be an escape as being escapist. I feel like more so than ever, this crazy, busy, overscheduled world that we live in, we're craving escape. It's something that we're longing for. And so if you can get that in a book, then how wonderful is that? It's low cost. It's safe. You know, there are so many different possibilities for escape. And I think that escape is the thing that first drew me to books as a kid. When I look back on it, I loved nothing more than to go to my local library, nestle into a corner. They had all these bean bags, and I would just get a little stack of books, and it was a getaway, and it was soothing. And I'm seeing that now with my son, James, who's 8 years old, in the way that books provide escape, and in doing so, transport him to another world. And right now, he's very into Greek mythology. So it's been super exciting to visit or revisit that world with him, because I loved Greek mythology when I was a kid, too. And frankly, I'm seeing how he benefits from escape, from turning inward and having a space to get lost in whatever story or storyline that's being presented to him through the words on the page.
Yeah, I love your take on critiquing reading as escapist when that's one of its fundamental purposes. It's like critiquing exercise because your heart beats faster or you're building muscles or something. I don't know. I always, you know, each year I read those annual lists of beach read recommendations, and I read them with envy. You know, they're designed to be escapist in most senses, I think. But I rarely shift gears with my reading in the summer. I don't like change the substance or the type of novels I read. But I sometimes wonder, now in discussing escapist fiction with you, I wonder if I should switch to something more lighter. I guess escapist doesn't have to be light, though, necessarily, I guess. My thing is, though, that I'm usually reading a novel that informs a writing project I'm working on, because I like reading books as a way to help me think about the books I'm writing. But, you know, that said, every novel is an escape in its way, even gritty, realistic novels. Beyond that, I'm very interested in the way that escaping through reading shouldn't be trivialized. I think of when Alice exclaims that Wonderland is getting curiouser and curiouser. That defines fantasy fiction to me, because fantasy fiction sparks our imagination to go beyond its usual boundaries and to become curious in a different way. And what better way to nourish your creativity than through fantastical curiosity? I mean, when I think of fantasy, I just think of it as feeding our sense of wonder of these other worlds. And also, just to switch gears about fantasy, I think it does have some real world applications or implications, because I think it's often easier to explore and discuss and solve moral problems when they're part of a fantasy story. For instance, it's easier to critique Cersei in Game of Thrones instead of a current political villain of the day. And on that note, Game of Thrones was a great meditation on the nature of power and greed in so many respects. After I watched the finale, I read an article about the final battle when Daenerys obliterates King's Landing and kills nearly a million innocent people in vengeful justice. And the article discussed how that was reminiscent of other historical battles that spawned debates about the killing of innocent people, such as Alexander the Great sacking Persepolis in revenge for Xerxes' burning of the Acropolis, or the United States' atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And Daenerys rationalizes her acts as an act of mercy toward future generations who will never again be held hostage by a tyrant. But we have to question whether she's going to create a peaceful world or a world full of fear and vengeance. And I think it's easier to frame this type of discussion in the fantasy realm than in a current or historical realm. And I hope hopefully that helps us learn to be better people in the end.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're mentioning all of this, because I'm thinking about James, who's my portal to fantasy right now, and he's a bit young for the kind of epic violence and tragedy that can be core to a lot of good fantasy because of all the things that you cite here, because it comes from history and human capacity for evil. And I don't read a lot of fantasy, which I've mentioned before, in part because of how much I read the books that I and publishing my own authors, which are largely memoir and commercial fiction. But after we interviewed Mary Robinette Cole for Right Minded a couple months back, I did download one of her books called The Calculating Stars, a lady astronaut novel, which she had spoken to in the interview, because I love the premise of the book and her focus on female protagonists. And so in this story, which I have to confess I have started and not finished, but it's awesome so far, a meteorite falls to Earth in 1952 and obliterates the East Coast, including Washington, D.C. And when we talked with Cory Doctorow a few weeks ago, we talked about cli-fi, right? Climate fiction. And I think this book gets into that a little bit as well, because in the aftermath of this cataclysmic event is massive climate change, which makes the Earth inhospitable for humanity. And the story is about how humanity needs to find other places to live, like the moon. And so the story is driven by Elma York, a pilot and mathematician. And I love the book so far because the stories of astronauts that we get are mostly men. And Emma brings with her this female sensibility. And because of the incredible imagination Cole brings to the book as she reimagines a future, the what would have happened if society had faced such an event in the 1950s. And then I also just want to mention that this happens to be a multi-award winning fantasy book that I got turned on to because of our own podcast. So that's pretty fun, too.
Yeah. And you know what? I found out that Mary Robinette wrote that during NaNoWriMo, the first draft of it. So it's pretty fun for me as well. And I love stories like that. And I think you do need the realm of fantasy to truly explore and experience these alternative what ifs. So that's a great purpose for fantasy fiction and writing, taking one step away from reality to the safe place, safe with quotation marks, a pretend helps us to prepare to look at the world's harsh realities in their face. I also think fantasy, though, can just be fun and escapist, and it should be celebrated on that level. You mentioned that you see James. What did you say? You said he was a portal to fantasy. I like that as just a definition for kids in general. They're portals to other worlds. And I envy kids because I think they live in much closer proximity to fantasy. And what a great way to walk through life. You know, I think I definitely miss Santa Claus. I miss the Easter Bunny. I'd love to have him back. and maybe I should try to have him back. there's always Bigfoot. But in fact, when I think about it, since I'm obviously older than my kids, and I've watched them read Harry Potter, and I really wish I would have grown up in the era when Harry Potter books were first being released. I kind of think they ushered in this golden age of fantasy. And Harry Potter gave us a new language for many things. You know, like it's interesting to me to see so many people who are under, say, 30 or so, identify as a Hogwart or a Slytherin on their social media profiles or in life, instead of like saying they're a Capricorn or a Taurus, which might have happened with my generation. So I think when I think about Harry Potter, I actually think that the Harry Potter series makes up the most important books of our era, really. I can't think of another book that has engaged so many readers and continues to engage them, and not only engage them, but provide them a lens to see the world through and act in. Is James old enough for Harry Potter yet, Brooke?
He definitely is at 8, but he hasn't gotten into it in the way that other kids I know in his friend circle have. And so for him, this year has been all about Percy Jackson because of the aforementioned obsession with Greek mythology. Mm-hmm. And I'm lucky because we have an author on our Spark Press imprint named Elaine Adams, who has a fantasy series called The Witches of Orkney and The Legends of Orkney. And the second book is just about to come out, called Rubicus Prophecy. And this is a middle grade series, and James is getting exposed to that, which I kind of love since it's one of my own authors. That's a series that features Nordic mythology. So I think we'll be milking this mythology thing for a while, or at least as long as it can sustain his interest. And when I was a kid, I really loved fantasy. I loved it in film as much as in books. I loved movies like The Neverending Story and The Labyrinth. And I think the reason fantasy is so amazing is because of how it stretches possibilities and suspends disbelief. Now, of course, it's such a wonderful thing for kids, but it's obviously a wonderful thing for adults too. And we're talking about this idea of kids as a portal, and you get to relive certain wonderful moments from childhood. And for me, that's also been through Roald Dahl. My mom read aloud almost every single Roald Dahl book that was ever written to my brother and I when we were kids. And then that's been something I've been doing with James as well. And Dahl's books turn out to be a bit more sophisticated than I remembered and a bit more gruesome too. At 7 and 8 years old for James, I've been like, oh, wow, these are kind of scary and gross and gory. But it's also been really fun to read about witches and giants and, of course, about James and the Giant Peach. So, Grant, what about you? I mean, Harry Potter sounds like it was a big deal in your household, even though you missed out on it when you were younger.
Yeah. Too bad I can't travel in time to the future. But I kind of did because my kids were a portal. It was great to experience Harry Potter alongside them. And, you know, they didn't just read the Harry Potter series once. They read it numerous times. In fact, they had a kind of competition with the kids in their class. And I just remember kids on the playground saying, I'm on whatever, you know, book three, and I'm reading it for the fourth time. And that was just amazing to me. It was like they were in one big generational book club. And when I was a kid, I didn't have any shared reading experiences. Reading was less emphasized than it is now, but it's also because there weren't any big reading series that commanded attention like Harry Potter and Percy Jackson, which was also big in our house, or is big. I can't imagine being a kid now and not reading Harry Potter and Percy Jackson, in fact. And the thing I found interesting while observing my kids read Harry Potter and listen into their conversation with friends was how Harry Potter was one big guidebook to life, essentially. It taught them things about love and persistence and fighting inner demons and outer demons. And it might be a book about other worlds, but it's grounded in an exploration of morality and how to be a good person in this world.
Yeah, that's so true. And it just runs the gamut. You know, clearly what we're seeing is that fantasy has this fantastical, fun, otherworldliness, and also this real capacity to stretch our thinking about the things that are really happening in this world that are scary and that we maybe have anxieties about. So it's all of it.
Yeah. And we will be right back after we go to another world for a short break, but we'll be back soon. Brooke, you know, I try to find ways to learn that fit into my life, which is one reason I'm excited that today's episode is sponsored by Great Courses, which emphasizes the self-driven, do-it-yourself aspects of learning by giving unlimited access to thousands of lectures by experts on topics, amazing array of topics, especially for writers. You know, I found utopian and dystopian works of literature, a course on ancient Greek history, a course on the secret of writing suspense, course on King Arthur, science fiction as philosophy, and many other courses. Really wonderful.
Yeah, ever since Great Courses started sponsoring our podcast, I have felt my brain and my life expanding. I'm calmer because I'm listening to courses instead of the news. My son and I have cool things to check out together, like life in the world's oceans and the mathematics of games and puzzles. There are 1,827 lectures on science alone.
Wow. And there are a bunch of courses on writing and publishing as well. And I think listeners might be interested in Jane Friedman's publishing course, which includes 24 courses that make up 12 hours of learning. Jane was on Right Minded earlier this year, and she touched on some of these topics, but she goes much more in depth in the course, of course. Pitching, querying, marketing, working with an editor, self-publishing, those are just a few of her topics.
And you can get Jane Friedman's publishing course and access to thousands of other courses by taking advantage of this special offer that Great Courses is giving our listeners. So please sign up, check it out. You can just get a month for free and see how you like it. So do us a favor too and do it, not only because it's good for you, but it's helpful to us. Try your free trial at thegreatcoursesplus.com/rightminded. And Grant, you made me sing last time and jingles get stuck in your head. So I was just wondering if you might treat us to your baritones for this spot.
Well, I'd rather do an interpretive dance of the URL since we're not on video like Great Courses is. I'll try to drum it. How about that? GreatCoursesPlus.com/rightminded without a hyphen. Did that work? Welcome back, everyone. I'm thrilled to introduce today's special guest, Victoria Schwab, who also goes by V.E. Schwab. I'm thrilled because she's a brilliant fantasy writer and is super popular among the NaNoWriMo community. Victoria is lucky to split her time between three different wonderful places, Nashville, where she grew up, Rouen, France, where she is right now in a stone cottage, and Edinburgh, where she says she buried her heart. Among her favorite things are black breakfast tea, which shouldn't be, she says, confused with Earl Grey, which tastes like my grandmother's old clothes steeped in warm water. I don't know if I'll ever be able to have an Earl Grey tea again and not think of that. And oh, she's written a bevy of books. She goes by Victoria for her YA or middle grade books, which include the Monsters of Verity series and the City of Ghosts series. And then if she's writing adult books, she goes by VE. And her adult fiction includes the Shades of Magic series. So thanks so much for joining us, Victoria.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be here.
Well, Victoria, on your website, you have the tagline, "For those who dream of stranger worlds." Why is it good to dream of stranger worlds?
Well, I mean, I think for me personally, that's just my origin story, if you will. I grew up dreaming of stranger worlds. I grew up wanting the world to be weird. And the first stories that I ever embarked on for myself were just fantasies of finding that strangeness, fantasies of, you know, hiking hillsides and finding something that looked like a doorway, missing a key, and always just kind of looking for ways where maybe the normal gave way to the paranormal or the strange. And so for me, it's just kind of where my inspiration comes from, is always believing that there's more than you can see. You just haven't known how to look for it.
Well, and Victoria, people sometimes think of fantasy as escapist. So it's interesting that Shades of Magic, your series, is largely a queer fantasy, and you rewrite the rules of power so that it's rooted in magic more than gender or sexuality. So I'm wondering if you could talk about your approach to fantasy as a commentary or a conversation about the reality we live in.
Absolutely. I think I write two different kinds of fantasy. I write fantasy that physically escapes, repositions the rule, something like Shades of Magic. And then I write fantasy that is more set like a skin over the top of our existing world. I'm definitely always intrigued by the proximity of magic, by the idea that it's just a step away, even in something like Shades of Magic. While it's a world away, it's also only a touch and a doorway and an instant. And I like that idea. But when you're writing fantasy, you have the incredible privilege and opportunity to rewrite those rules, to redetermine what is norm. And I think it's a major disservice when we see fantasy worlds built from scratch in which all of the hierarchy, all of the power dynamics are exactly as they are in our own world. Because what that says to me is that the person writing that story already sees themselves in a position of power. They are the default. And so for me, what I'm most interested in is not erasing, you know, inequity and inequality. There's always going to be a hierarchy whenever there is power, but simply about shifting, like, okay, what if we design a world where power and control is not based on race and is based far less on sexuality and gender? And what if it's based on who controls physical magic? How does that change the dynamics? And how does the dynamics do the same? Where are the universals there? But for me, as a queer female author, you know what? I want to be able to see myself in a position of power, and I want to be able to center readers who so often see themselves cast to the fringes of the narrative.
That's so interesting, Victoria. I'm interested in world building, and I usually think of world building in terms of what you kind of described earlier, like when you go on a hike and you imagine a doorway in the middle of a hill. But I've read that you interpret world building very differently than that, in the sense that you say that you write primarily about outsiders, and that in order to understand outsiders, you need to understand insiders. And then in order to understand insiders, you have to understand the world that they are inside of, the world they inhabit.
Exactly.
So can you talk about how looking at outsiders and insiders through this lens then leads to the physical worlds you create on the page?
Of course. I mean, I'm curious about what makes a person feel like they don't belong. You know, this goes back to my very first novel, The Near Witch. I was always interested in this concept of there's two kinds of outsiders. There's those of us who are born in a different place and then transported. I grew up moving around a lot, always felt like the physical outsider. And then those of us who are born within a framework, within a community, and feel othered within it. Like for my own personal experience, it was being a member of the queer community, and taking a very long time to figure out that that was why I felt like I didn't belong. I didn't have vocabulary for it for a very long time. But when we take these characters and these figures who so often exist at the fringes, the outsiders, literally, and we center them in the narrative, all of a sudden we get to ask the questions of, okay, where don't you fit? And why don't you fit? And what is it that you are chafing against? Is it someone like Kel who feels like his power and his isolation make him feel like he doesn't belong in his found family because it wasn't choice? Is it someone who is his exact opposite, like Delilah Bard, who is technically an outsider in every way and yet can make herself an insider in everywhere she goes? And you start to examine power. You start to examine why does somebody belong? Why don't they belong? What makes us feel lonely and afraid? What do we want and what do we fear? What are we willing to do to get the things we want? And it starts to provoke really interesting questions. And I think even though I build quite large worlds, I try to keep the questions very small. Because when I actually started my adult career writing a book called Vicious, which was about supervillains. And I think when we think of supervillains, we automatically think of the very large concept of world domination. And the problem with a concept like world domination or control or being the strongest is it's not actually very easy for a person, a reader, to wrap their minds around. Very few of us go through the world thinking that our goal in life is world domination. But most of us have felt slighted. Most of us have felt left behind or abandoned or like somebody wronged us. These are very personal, very intimate sensations. And so regardless of how big a world I'm building, I try to make the conflict very, very intimate because I want readers to be able to say, I know exactly how that feels. Now, you shouldn't be able to tell how one of the universe's greatest magicians feels, but if I can bring his power down to a sense of pure, awkward, neurotic isolation, then the reader has a lot easier time wrapping their head around that.
Grant was saying earlier in our banter before you came on that he thinks that Harry Potter and that series might be the most important of its era for many reasons, but particularly because Harry Potter has become such a shared and communal experience. And so many people across generations, across geographical distances and other things have bonded over Harry Potter. And I'm curious if it had an impact or what impact it might have had on you as a reader and writer.
Oh my goodness. So I'm 31. I'm about to turn 32. And that means that if you do the math, I am of that rare generation that literally grew up with Harry Potter. I was 11 when the first book came out. I was 11 when I read it. And so it defined my entire adolescence and young adulthood. It defined everything for me. Not only that, but I was not a huge reader. I was very proficient. I could read, but I had yet to find a story which made me forget where I was, which made the real world fall away. And Harry Potter absolutely was that for me. But also, if we look at like, whenever somebody asks me who the scariest character in Harry Potter is, it's not Voldemort. It's never Voldemort. Voldemort is somebody who lives for world domination. It's Dolores Umbridge. It's a figure who is evil in a far smaller, far more mundane way. And I think really the themes in Harry Potter at the heart of it, the intimacy of those friendships and rivalries and adversaries and the small evils and the big goods, I think that really informed my own understanding of what we relate to.
That's so interesting. I read that you write fantasy for readers who don't know if they like fantasy. And I found that so interesting because I would have imagined a fantasy writer to write mainly to diehard fantasy fans. So I'm very curious why you take that approach and how does that influence your writing process and story world?
Well, I'm a hard sell. And I was always a hard sell. And the best example I can give is growing up, I was extremely averse to the idea of Lord of the Rings. And it was one because it was held up as this pinnacle of achievement, but also it was because it had maps and it had fictional languages. And at the time, what I read into that was a kind of gatekeeping. It was early days of digital fandom, but there was this sense that you had to prove that you deserved to be in the fandom. There were no casual fans. You know, it was this diehard sense. And that I found really off-putting, especially as kind of a blossoming reader who felt like I didn't deserve to call myself a fantasy reader or a massive fan. And so one of the things, it's not that I write fantasy for people who don't like fantasy. It's that I'm really interested in the accessibility of stories. I want to earn readers who think they don't like fantasy because they've been provided a very specific definition of that fantasy. And in some ways it's the sheer like scope and size and complexity, though I think my worlds are fairly complex as well. I think more of it also was just coming down to that it was like so aggressively white and male and heteronormative, and not to drop like a huge number of keywords there, but I didn't relate to it. I didn't see myself. And so I really want to write fantasy, one that is highly accessible in that sense of maybe you think you don't like fantasy, but it's because you haven't found the right fantasy, the right doorway. I want to be that doorway for somebody, but also because I try to make my works as fantastical as they are, far more reflective of the real world in terms of the people who get to see themselves on the page, the people who represent the cast. It's interesting because that's so important to me. And yet I am extraordinarily averse to like diversity checklist. I'm averse to stories that just feel like somebody is going down a diversity checklist and saying, well, we need one of these and one of these and one of these. I think that does just as much harm to fantasy as the norms, which are being perpetuated for the last 50, 60 years. But it's more just that I want to write the kind of fantasy that I want to read. And the kind of fantasy that I want to read is the kind that feels more like anime. Anime is a really fascinating medium and genre in that if you watch anime, there's almost no hand-holding for the world building. It's incredibly detailed, complex worlds. And everything you learn as it's relevant to the story. You never get detail for detail's sake. You never get world building for world building's sake. You learn as you go and as the world building relates to the plot and the conflict and the characters. And that's really what interests me. It's kind of what I hold up as a good bar for immediately kind of consuming world building.
It's exciting to hear you talk about all of this, Victoria, because we've talked about this on episodes in the past, how important it is for kids and adults, but especially younger readers, to see themselves in the books that they read. So thank you for talking about it and doing the work. And I know that you read more than 100 books a year. And so I'm wondering what your favorite fantasy novels are, and especially those that illuminate the real world in a particular way that excites you.
Oh, goodness. So yeah, I read a lot of books a year. I probably say that about a third of them are nonfiction, and then the two thirds are fiction. I read every form and format and genre, and I find that I tend to gravitate towards the weird. Like I just finished reading and blurbing two books, one called Gideon the Ninth, which comes out in September, which is essentially lesbian necromancers in space. That is one of the coolest books I've ever read. And Magic for Liars, which is like a grown-up Harry Potter noir. and I'm a big fan I'm a big fan of things which exist in the in-between of definitions. I did a piece for NPR last year that was basically only dedicated to those books that didn't fit easy categories. There's a fantasy novel. I would call it fantasy. It's not fantasy perhaps in the way that Brandon Sanderson or Tolkien are fantasy, but it's fantastical and strange. And that's a book called The Library at Mount Char, which came out about 3 or 4 years ago, but just kind of sunk its teeth into me and never let go. There's a book called The Tiger's Daughter, which I always, by K.R. Sonnet Rivera, which I always liken to like a Miyazaki film gone rogue and gayer. And I hesitate to even say that I have favorites. I think I have formatives. I think I have stories which get their teeth into me. I mean, growing up, it was everything from Harry Potter to Neverwhere by Neil Gaiman to Susanna Clarke's Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell to Holly Black's Coldest Girl in Cold Town. Like, I just want things to be ambitious and I want them to reach. And maybe they're not gonna grab what they're reaching for every time, but I have so much respect for things which try. I would rather see someone try, like, no holds barred. There's a really fabulous series by an author named Nicholas Eames called King of the Wild, and the second one is called Bloody Rose. And it's this weird fantasy with essentially like rock band style mercenary groups that compete for like the attention in this rock band style. And again, like I want things which are just no holds barred. I just read Middle Game by Shannon Maguire and fell head over heels in love for it. But if I had to try and explain it in anything less than a 2-page write-up, I feel like I would fail miserably. And maybe that's the commonality between everything that I love, is that it's not easily quantified or defined.
That's so great, Victoria. I was writing down titles as you were saying them. I'm going to have to re-listen to them to go order all those books. You know, fantasy, we keep track of what novels what genres NaNoWriMo writers are writing in. And this probably won't surprise you, but fantasy is the most popular genre year over year. And so I'm interested to hear what your best writing advice is for fantasy authors in particular, just to conclude the interview.
Well, I would say that part of it is that, to take a note from anime, one of the most often questions I get asked when I'm teaching for fantasy is, how do you know which pieces of world building are essential to include? And so I think it's because we can, as we're world building, we can kind of end up playing like Sims instead of writing a novel. We forget that there has to be conflict and plot and character, and we just kind of build the worlds. So I do really always kind of harken back to that thought process of, when you're describing something or when you're constructing something, is it relevant? And I always remind up-and-coming writers that when you're writing a story, specifically fantasy, you are writing through a pair of eyes. Maybe you're writing omniscience, in which case that's a little harder, but omniscience has kind of fallen out of fashion. But if you're writing either first person or third person close, you are writing through a character's eyes, through a character's viewpoint. Now, you might have 8 viewpoints, or you might have 1 or 2, but every character in your novel is going to perceive the world in a different way. And so paying attention to the fact that in Shades of Magic series, Kel and Lila will never notice the same things in Red London. One of them has lived there all their lives, and one of them has just arrived. And just even paying attention to what your characters notice and why, and then to keeping the details, keeping the icebergs as tips, keeping the tips of the icebergs, the things which you choose to focus on, reflective of a greater whole, instead of creating the entire iceberg for your audience. And the other piece of advice I would give is actually a bit more holistic for no matter what people are writing. This is a controversial piece of advice, and I don't want it to come off as prescriptive. Again, I'm only speaking to what works for me. But one of the greatest challenges that any writer faces is finishing what they start. The vast majority of people who start a novel will never finish it. It's a grim statistic, but it's true. And I'm up there. I love to quit things. I am constantly daunted by how difficult writing is. And so when I sit down to write a novel, I know the ending. And I know the ending because it transforms a desert into a field. It transforms this wasteland expanse that I can't see across, that I don't know where I'm going, into a finite distance. And it gives me something to work toward. And on good days, it keeps me excited to get there. And on bad days, it keeps me from quitting. So those are the two pieces of advice I give.
I love that metaphor for finishing. Thank you so much for talking with us, Victoria. This is really valuable advice.
Of course, of course. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, everybody. We'll be right back with today's takeaway. This week, we hope you'll join She Writes University and New York Times bestseller Taylor Jenkins Reid in her first ever online course. For just $99, get an inside look at the extensive research she did, from reading rock and roll bios to studying dynamic figures like Elizabeth Taylor and Lucille Ball. Learn the methods that made her novels so compelling that it got the attention of Reese Witherspoon and led to her TV deal with Amazon Studios. Check out Taylor's course and 7 other author-led courses at shewritesuniversity.com, brought to you by Moms Who Don't Have Time to Read Books, a podcast that you can download wherever you get your podcasts.
For today's writing action, I'm thinking of our conversation with Cory Doctorow. And Brooke, you mentioned reading Naomi Alderman's The Power, which is a world in which women have more physical power than men. And just that simple trait alters a lot of things. And I'm very curious about taking one aspect of reality and kind of putting it through the what if machine, and then another world comes out. So this week's writing action, in order to nourish that more fantastical side of your brain, I'd like people to brainstorm some possible fantasy worlds by just simply flipping things, such as making women physically stronger than men, or pushing, you know, other things to their outer limits. For instance, what will Florida be like 100 years from now if it keeps sinking into the ocean? Or what if artificial intelligence eventually reduces the need to work? What happens to us as humans if we reside in a state of luxury, or will it be a state of luxury? You know, I keep reading about advances in anti-aging and predictions that humans are going to routinely live past 100 or 110 and perhaps beyond. And I wonder who will be if we live that long, or if that will be a good thing or a bad thing. So if you think about those situations and kind of metaphorically add in some wizards, some good and evil fairies, a couple of alchemists, a troll or two, and a unicorn, and just see where your story goes. You don't have to end up writing it. You can just brainstorm some scenarios and just, you know, keep that fantasy muscle pumping if you don't ordinarily write fantasy.
Not to mention, it will make your days a lot more fun just to imagine unicorns around in your neighborhood, which I love. So thanks for that, Grant. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Right Minded is a weekly podcast. You can download it every Monday. You can download this anywhere you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and elsewhere. And we still need those ratings. So please think about giving us some stars or a review, but mostly sharing with your friends so that we can continue to keep this thing going. And thanks so much. We'll see you next week.